This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tina Fey, has written a hilarious new memoir called Bossy Pants, in which she writes about her life before she became famous and tells great stories about being the head writer on Saturday Night Live, serving as the co-anchor of Weekend Update, creating and starring in her own TV series 30 Rock, and returning to Saturday Night Live to portray Sarah Palin. She also writes about being a daughter and a mother. Last year, Tina Fey became the youngest winner of the Kennedy Center's Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Last month, at Comedy Central's first Comedy Awards ceremony, she won for Best Actress in a Comedy for her performance opposite Steve Carell in Date Night. She won 2 Golden Globe Awards for her performances on 30 Rock, and the show won a Golden Globe for Best Comedy Series. She's won a total of 7 Emmys for writing, acting, and producing. Tina Fey, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is great to have you here. Your book is hysterical, so I'd like you to start by reading an excerpt from it, and I'd like you to read The Mother's Prayer for Its Daughter.
It would be my pleasure.
Thank you.
I will try to read it in what I imagine is the vocal style of Danielle Steele. The Mother's Prayer for Its Daughter. First, Lord, no tattoos. May neither the Chinese symbol for truth nor Winnie the Pooh holding the FSU logo stain her tender haunches. May she be beautiful but not damaged, for it's the damage that draws the creepy soccer coach's eye, not the beauty. When the crystal meth is offered, may she remember the parents who cut her grapes in half and stick with beer. Lead her away from acting, but not all the way to finance. Something where she can make her own hours, but still feel intellectually fulfilled and get outside sometimes and not have to wear high heels. What would that be, Lord? Architecture? Midwifery? Golf course design? I'm asking you, because if I knew, I'd be doing it, you damn it. May she play the drums to the fiery rhythm of her own heart with the sinewy strength of her own arms, so she need not lie with drummers. O Lord, break the internet forever, that she may be spared the misspelled invective of her peers and the online marketing campaign for Rape Hostel 5, Girls Just Want to Get Stabbed. And when she one day turns on me and calls me a bitch in front of Hollister, give me strength, Lord, to yank her directly into a cab in front of her friends, for I will not have that nonsense. I will not have it.
That's so funny. It's Tina Fey reading from her new book, which is called Bossy Pants. Your book ends with you thinking about, should you become pregnant again because you're 40 and is that too old? And should your daughter have a sibling?
Yes, yeah.
Did you have any idea that by the time the book was published you would be pregnant again?
I was pregnant by the time I was finishing editing the book.
So you knew.
So by the time we were finishing editing, yes, and putting the manuscript to bed and putting it on a train to Boston, I was quite nauseous.
So your mother was 40 when she had you, a kind of unplanned pregnancy?
Well, I think, I say this in the book, but for years I had it in my head, well, she was 40, my mom was 40, and then I sort of did the math, and she was actually 39 when she delivered me, because her birthday's in December. And I think she had had my brother 8 years earlier, and then in sort of 1960s medicine, they had told her at some point, like, oh, no, you're done. Don't even worry about it. For whatever reason, I think she had, you know, I'm sure she would love it if I was on the radio saying she had endometriosis or whatever, but she had some kind of issues and they said, no, you're out of business. And so I was surprised. Yeah.
So what did she tell you about being pregnant at 39?
She was back to work at the time in a brokerage firm here in Philadelphia. And she said that, you know, the girls around the office, I guess it was Mad Men era, so we would call them girls, the women working in the office, referred to her as Mrs. Here comes Mrs. Fey and her change of life baby. And it was a human oddity.
My guest is Tina Fey, and she has a new book called Bossy Pants. How much are you writing now on 30 Rock?
Well, this year was tough because I was finishing the book. In terms of actual drafts that are mine, I think I had only 3 scripts that have my name on it, and 2 of them were co-written this year. In the past, and hopefully next year, I'll be able to write 4 or 5 actual drafts myself. But every script kind of goes through all of us.
Well, let me play a clip from 30 Rock. And this is really funny. It's from the first season. And someone on your staff she's very young, she wants to get married and be a mother. be a hot mom. And you're kind of giving her, trying to give her advice, like, are you really ready to marry yet? So here's my guest, Tina Fey, in a scene from season one of 30 Rock.
So, Ceree, how long have you known this guy that you're marrying?
It'll be 2 months and 3 weeks. Oh, you'd love him, Liz. He's so funny. He does this thing where he screams at limo drivers.
It just kind of seems like you're rushing into it a little bit.
I guess, but we both want to have babies while it's still cool. I already have all the names picked out. If it's a girl, Bookcase, or Sandstorm, or maybe Hat, but that's more of a boy's name.
Yeah, I was gonna say. It's just, you're so young, Ceree. There's no big hurry to have babies. I mean, there are other things in life, like having a career, and working, and having a job, and working.
You can have a career at any time, but you only have a really short period where you can be a young, hot mom. If you wait too long, you could be like 50 at your kid's graduation.
50's not that old, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you 50 now?
That's Tina Fey in a scene from 30 Rock. Did you write that scene?
I don't remember. I know. I think that script is a script by Jack Burdett. But I'm sure I helped contribute to that scene. That's from an episode called The Baby Show.
There's one story in your book that I so related to. Your mother made you try on a bra over your shirt at JCPenney's.
Yes.
And I don't know how many girls went through this kind of thing with their mother where you have to, like, try on clothes,
yeah,
not in the dressing room, but in the middle of...
Yeah,
in the middle of the store,
sorry,
where everybody's going to see you, and then the store manager, if there is one, is going to be really angry too. How horrible was that?
At the time, it was horrifying, I'd developed very early, and was probably in, you know, fifth grade getting a bra. I say in the book that I developed breasts so early and so strangely high. That it wasn't the bra was more to clarify what they were, that they were not a goiter or something. that was, and it was, yeah, it was mortifying. But in that same way that I can absolutely see making that same mistake of, because you're so used to, you transition as a mother from, at some point, from literally just, you know, pulling a booger out of that person's nose whenever you see one, until at some point they assert to you, like, no, I'm a person. You can't. You know, fix my underpants on the subway.
I watched you accept the Mark Twain Comedy Award,
mm-hmm,
at the Kennedy Center, and your parents were in the audience. They looked so proud of you, in spite of the fact that you made a joke about preparing to send them to a home.
I did. They rolled with some jokes there.
Yeah, but were they proud of you when you decided to move to Chicago to study improv?
You know, they were very, yes, they were very supportive always. And
so that's a risky thing. They really were okay with that?
They were okay with it, yeah. And they never, you know, to their credit, they never said, like, you like entertainment? Are you sure you don't want to be an entertainment lawyer? Like that kind of depressing thing. They, you know, because my dad is a painter, and so I think he understood that part of me that wanted to pursue this. And also understanding, you know, wanting to pursue that before you have commitments, before you have a family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they knew that we weren't, neither my brother or I would ever really end up, you know, coming back to them destitute. We always had jobs to, you know, pay for our classes or whatever, you know, whatever we were interested in.
So you worked at the Evanstown Y?
Yes, the Evanston.
Evanston.
Illinois McGaw YMCA.
Yeah, and then it got a spot at Second City.
Yeah.
And, you know, you describe some of the rules of improv,
mm-hmm,
and one of them is, you know, make statements, don't ask questions, and put the onus on the other person, mm-hmm, to come up with something. You come up with something, give it to them,
mm-hmm,
and then they have to react with something.
Exactly.
And you say that this applies to women, too. Speak in statements instead of apologetic questions.
Yes.
Were you ever in that category of speaking in apologetic questions and having to be more assertive, or speaking all the time in statements that sound like questions? You know,
oh, yeah. Hopefully I never really had that behavior, that kind of.
Exactly.
Once again, maybe a little on the old side. I think that became standard issue in the late 80s. I don't know. I mean, I'm a shy person, and so I definitely learned in those early improv classes to initiate and to step forward. And you learn so much in those classes because you also eventually, once you get better at improv, you learn, like, you know, when do you step forward? An improv Olympic thing, I think, too, which is another improv theater. You know, you ask improvisers who have been a couple classes in, a couple sessions, whatever, you say, well, no, here's a question. When do you enter a scene? And people say, well, when you have an idea. No. When you enter a scene. When you think of something funny, say, no. And the answer is, when do you enter a scene, is when someone needs you. You're only to enter when someone needs you. And so if you're observing the scene and you feel it start to lull, or if someone in the scene refers to something that it would be beneficial to see. And so it's this great mindset of contributing, but as a group. It's not, you never just come in. I mean, people do, because you always make mistakes in the practice of it, but come in just because that scene looks fun and I want to be in it too, or I've got a great idea for a loud character that could enter this scene.
How did you learn in improv compared to what you learned in more traditional acting classes?
Well, for me, I had studied drama at the University of Virginia with great teachers, and we studied Stanislavski technique and Meisner technique and all these different things. And I tried my best, but I was never sure when I was doing those things. I never understood what you were supposed to be thinking about during the actual performance. Am I supposed to be thinking about the journal that I made for the character? Am I thinking about my moment before? And with improv, because it is more of a sport and you must stay focused, and what you're supposed to be thinking about is actively listening to that person, because you truly don't know what the next thing is that you're going to say. You're listening that to your partner so that you can truly respond. That was the first technique that clicked for me personally, because I think that all acting techniques are all different sets of tricks to just give you something to think about other than yourself in the moment, to take your, so that you're not kind of watching yourself act, which leads to all kinds of awkwardness on stage. And so for me, improvisation was the only one that worked.
Do you use that on 30 Rock?
I try. Yeah, I try. And then it's interesting because once you get onto acting on film, then there's you can distract yourself with all the different sort of technical things that you just have to do, which is just be sort of physically precise and
hitting your mark, so the lighting is right.
Yeah, staying out of each other's light. And, but yes, I would say, even though we're not improvising, try to be thinking that way. Yeah,
you describe how when you're acting with Alec Baldwin on 30 Rock, that he knows how to let the camera come to him.
Yes,
and he's sometimes like so quiet in his lines that you can barely hear him, even though you're standing next to him. Early on, did you say, "I need more from you"? You
oh
have
my goodness!
To do more.
No, I did know going into it that he was doing it correctly, and that what I needed to do was to observe him, to try to be more like him. That was actually a lesson I learned. I will say I learned that lesson from Rachel McAdams. You know, the actress Rachel McAdams. She was in Mean Girls, and she was is a real, legit actor and film actor. And that was the first movie set I had ever been on. And I would watch, I would stand with the director sometimes and watch her scenes. And I would say to the director, like, I don't know, it's really small. And like, is she doing it? Like, and then watching her on film, watching the dailies, I'm like, oh, yes, she's amazing. She's a film actor. She's not pushing. And so I kind of learned that lesson from watching her a couple years before.
I want to play another clip. And you know how we were talking about that, you know, you say actresses shouldn't, like, speak in questions all the time? Like, you have to make statements. So this is from an episode of 30 Rock called Sexy Baby. And this is like a new writer on the show.
Oh, yeah, the episode, the actual title of the episode is TGS Hates Women.
Oh, right, yeah. Because this writer's hired to kind of change things around because the show's being accused of being misogynistic. Mm-hmm. So this new writer's hired, but she's a real sexy baby type. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to tell her to, like, act, like, knock it off. you don't have to put on that act when you're not acting. You know, just, like, knock it off and be yourself. And so here's that scene.
Abby, thanks for meeting me here. This place is very special to me.
Is this where you got your V-card punched?
What? No. Does this look like the makeup room of a clown academy? No. This is a statue, and I know you know this, of Eleanor Roosevelt, first lady to the world, champion of the rights of women, and the lid on my high school lunchbox. Look, I know it can be hard. Society puts a lot of pressure on us to act a certain way. But TGS is a safe place, so you can drop the sexy baby act and lose the pigtails.
But I like my pigtails. My uncle says they're sexy.
Enough with the gross jokes and that voice. I want you to talk in your real voice.
This is my real voice. And the whole sexy baby thing isn't an act. I'm a very sexy baby. I can't help it if men are attracted to me. Like that homeless guy. He likes what he sees.
Okay, that could be for me.
It's not. It's for her.
Abby, I'm trying to help you.
Really? By judging me on my appearance and the way I talk? And what's the difference between me using my sexuality and you using those glasses to look smart?
I am smart. I placed out a freshman German.
Or Lutz using that sexy English accent to get me in the sack.
No, you didn't. Lutz? Is that even possible? I mean, I was there when he belvedered. God, Abby, you can't be that desperate for male attention.
You know what, Liz? I don't have to explain myself to you. My life is none of your business.
Except it is, because you represent my show and you represent my gender in this business and you embarrass me.
Kiss!
Dude, I am sorry, but this is who I am. Deal with it.
It's my guest Tina Fey with Kristen Milioti. Am I saying her name?
I think right. So, yeah.
In a scene from 30 Rock. Do you know actresses like that who, or writers like that who have that kind of like sexy baby persona?
Mm-hmm. It's funny because as we were listening to that, I was thinking like, yeah, it's just your typical sitcom 2-minute long discussion about gender. I'm like, what? No wonder no one wants to watch this program. Yeah, I was remembering as we were listening to it that the thing about the moment, and this script was written by Ron Weiner, but I remember one of the things that we talked about this story a lot in the room, the moment where I say to her, talk in your real voice, is actually a thing that I remembered from a college acting class where there was a girl, this beautiful, really beautiful, voluptuous little tiny actress who had one of these tiny voices. And I had one of my acting teachers, I remember she was doing a monologue in class, and he very gently said to her, he's like, okay, I want you to do the monologue again, and I would like you to use your adult woman voice. And she did. And all the other women in the class remember looking at each other like, I knew it. I knew that voice wasn't real. And that moment was kind of inspired by that, because sometimes those voices are real. Sometimes they are a habit that's just kind of worn in. But this episode was – that story is so kind of loaded and complex and that I was really glad that we did it. And I think it's confused and sort of delighted the internet in a way, because you that it sort of opens up more questions than answers. I mean, for me, it was about – Liz is in the wrong to try. She thinks she's doing the right thing by trying to correct this woman, by trying to say, like, you don't have to be this way. And at the same time, this girl has every right to be whoever she wants. And so that to me was what the story was about, that it's just such a tangled up issue. The way women present themselves, whether or not they choose to, you know, as I say, put their thumbs in their panties on the cover of Maxim, and the way women judge each other back and forth for it, it's a complicated issue. And we didn't go much further saying anything about it other than to say, yeah, it's a complicated issue, and we're all kind of figuring it out as we go. And in the episode, we have a fake website that we're referring to, a feminist website called joanofsnark.com, that the women at jezebel.com immediately recognized that it was their website, basically. And and it was kind of a you know, reaction to the way I saw Olivia Munn, who was, of course,
on the Daily Show,
which was, you know, I don't have the answer, but I find it interesting, is all I can say, is I find it interesting that Olivia gets people go after her sometimes on these sites because she's beautiful. I think is part of it. You know, I think she was posing. I think if she were kind of an aggressive, kind of heavier girl with a, you know, Le Tigre mustache posing in her underpants, people would be like, that's amazing. Good for you. But because she is very beautiful, people are like, that's, you're using that. It's just a mess. We can't figure it out.
So when you got to Saturday Night Live as a writer, how long did it take for you to feel comfortable actually writing something?
I came from Second City, where we had the process was that you would improvise and re-improvise and re-improvise and work together, and then eventually write down, kind of just record the final version of your what you've improvised, and that would become a sketch. And then my first week at Saturday Night Live, the way it works there is you come in on Tuesday, and by Wednesday morning you have to turn in about 20 pages of writing. And that first week I completely froze. I couldn't think of anything. It was just too fast a gear shift. I was only at Second City a week before. There was only, you know, I left on a Friday and or I left on a Monday and was at SNL the following Monday. And so I found, you know, I had some pieces that I had written to try to get the job, and I ended up turning them in. And so it took a couple, by the next week I was able to write something and turn it in. And I think the week after that, maybe I got something that actually made its way to the dress rehearsal.
Do you remember the first sketch you wrote that got on the air?
Yes. The first sketch I wrote was a sort of a commercial parody for a fake Lifetime documentary called I Took a Gay Guy to Prom. And it was of women realizing, it's a very serious documentary about realizing that the men they had taken to their prom were actually gay.
And how'd you come up with that?
I think was going back to my summer theater days and how many boys I knew like that. And at the time, I would sit and I would try to think of things that the women in the cast could be in. Because I did feel, I was like, well, I think that's why I'm here, is to try to help them.
And who were the women that first season?
Oh, they were great. It was Molly Shannon and Sherry O'Terry and Anna Gasteyer.
But you weren't writing for yourself because you weren't a performer.
No. I wasn't. And I was never really a sketch performer, only a tiny. I did Weekend Update, which I would contribute to writing for that. But the only time I was ever in sketches usually was when we just flat out ran out of bodies.
And why is that? I mean, you'd been a performer.
I had been, but I'd been hired as a writer. And so part of it was just, to me, the etiquette of, like, that's not what you're here for. And two, you know, those women were very good. And it is the thing of, you know, when do you enter? When you're needed. You know, and you're not needed.
And of the many guest hosts that you wrote for, who was a pleasure to write for?
Well, Alec Baldwin is always a pleasure. Queen Latifah was always very good. Gwyneth Paltrow actually has a great ear or instinct for sketch comedy, because you have to kind of make a quick choice and go with it and not really overthink it. And she was really good. Ben Affleck was always really good. And then there are people, I don't know if I got anything on with him, but I remember enjoying his show very much, was John McCain. Because sometimes when you have a person who's all the way not an actor, it's just delightful to watch them kind of be game and try.
That was pre-you doing Sarah Palin.
Yes.
So you already had a pre-existing relationship.
Yes.
With him. Did that help?
I think so. We all liked him tremendously when he hosted, and my husband and I went down, I guess in 2004, to Washington, and I did a photo shoot with Senator McCain, and he gave us, we spent the afternoon together and gave us a tour of the Capitol and stuff. And in fact, we did this cover for Life magazine together when they were trying to bring Life magazine back. It was sort of a nonpartisan get out the vote cover. And Lorne Michaels always reminds me that Senator McCain has that framed in his office from 2004 until 2008. And he thinks that subliminally that's why he liked Sarah Palin when he saw her, because he was used to looking at me standing next to him in that picture.
So when you were running for Alec Baldwin as a guest host on Saturday Night Live, what's the favorite sketch, your favorite sketch that you wrote for him?
I've written a couple for him that I like. One was, they were all pretty strange too and a little bit sexual. One, the weirdest one, and I definitely didn't know him at all during this. I remember just getting the embarrassed kind of giggles when we were rehearsing. It was a weird one where Molly Shannon played a volunteer hospital clown, and he looking as his most dashing self in silk pajamas in the bed was supposedly a 4 or 5 year old girl who had a disease that made her look like a very handsome adult man. And Molly, through the course of the scene, is very attracted to him, but is constantly reminded that it's actually a child and that it's a really weird sketch.
What inspired that?
I don't know. I think I used to have a thing where I would take the host and I would try to think of ideas. I would make two columns, a list of ideas that went with their type and ideas that went strongly against type. And so that, I think that came from that. I'm like, well, he doesn't look like a 4-year-old girl.
So what was his type? What,
you know, his type would be action star, old-timey movie star, cowboy, anything, you know, he's kind of rugged. hair model, you know, anything that was.
If you were writing for yourself, what would your type be?
I think I tried to do this one of the times I hosted to try to think of things. My type would be teacher, librarian, Ukrainian cleaning woman, mother.
So how did it change your life to be a person on TV as opposed to behind the scenes?
Well, it's very fun, you know, and it's very fun to be a writer at Saturday Night Live, but it is more fun to be able to do both. And the most basic level, they give you a party dress to wear every week to the party, and they do fix your hair and makeup. And so when you're a writer and you hit that after-show party, you're, you know, exhausted and you maybe combed your hair and you maybe bought yourself something at Ann Taylor. But if you're on the show, you're all fancy. So in that most basic level, it was an upgrade in the job. And the other thing about Update is that it is the only segment in the show that is never cut. So you never have that fear and disappointment that the sketch players have. It's the only segment in the show where you, week after week, look right into the camera and tell America your name.
True.
Because a lot of times, I realize now that I'm on the show too, you see the sketch players, you see them a lot, and you see them in wigs, and when they're new, you go, wait, which one is that? Which guy is that? And in Update, you look like a version of yourself, and every week you say, hi, this is me. And so it's career changing.
What was the hardest week for you doing Weekend Update when there was a real catastrophe in the news?
We started in 2000, and so we had to come back to do the first show after 9/11, and those months were definitely the hardest because everyone had to refigure out what jokes were okay, and you know, Lauren's advice at the time was excellent because it was just, you know, we just have to trust our own instinct as our guide if we're here, and if this joke makes us feel queasy, it's probably not a good joke, and if it seems funny, it's probably funny.
Do you have an example of a queasy one and a funny one?
Gosh, I can't remember specific jokes. I remember one of the first times I thought, okay, well, this is funny, was Horatio Sanz did a bit on Update where we would cut away to something else, and he was, I forget the name of it, it was something like it was with a government agency, something, you know, anxiety department or whatever, but he was with a government agency responsible for fear and panic, and he was just had a coffee cup and it was all like, I don't know, we're on a super yellow alert, and just him doing mostly a lot of shaky hand bits with his coffee cup and being spooked by his own file cabinet. But it seemed like jokes about talking about our own fears and our own, and calling that stuff out were the first things that felt okay.
And you were probably pretty afraid yourself.
Yeah, I was pretty anxious, and I sort of experienced kind of. And I'm sure, you know, most people did at that time would have just sort of a panic attack in the middle of a meeting in there. And we also, this is in the book, we had about a month after that, we were working in the building when they found anthrax. I remember sitting in my dressing room at 30 Rockefeller Plaza trying to write topical jokes and looking up at Lester Holt on MSNBC who said, breaking news, we have found anthrax in 30 Rockefeller Plaza. I was like, that's where I am right now. Come on. And I just left. I just got up and left.
And then Lauren called you.
And yeah, I left. And I walked out the door and I left. I didn't say anything to anybody. I left and walked all the way home. And Lauren called me that night and said, you know, everyone's back. We're ordering dinner if you want to come back. And kind of, I thought was very good leadership way of, instead of saying like, you're being an idiot and you're embarrassing yourself and everyone's here and my instinct would be like to say, you know, everyone's here. What, you think you're so special that you're not here? You know, he just sort of gently guided me back to the building.
I wasn't planning on talking to you a lot about your Sarah Palin portrayal because we talked about it at the time that you were doing it, and you were so great and so interesting on that. So I thought we wouldn't emphasize that this time around. But I do have a couple of questions about it.
Okay.
What I didn't know is that you. Among the things I didn't know is that you were a little uncomfortable about doing it because you'd written a Hillary sketch that you thought was misinterpreted.
I had done when I had hosted the show, I guess right after the writer's strike, Seth and Amy had asked if I wanted to come and do some kind of anything on Update. And so we did this very kind of hastily written, especially when you're the host, if you're going to go on Update, it doesn't get written until Saturday. And so it was this kind of woman news piece. And yeah, and the intention of the piece was to kind of, I remember talking with Amy at the time, to kind of address that in the campaign, people were kind of, media and voters or whatever, were kind of preferring Obama to Hillary. And there was this vague feeling that he was just kind of more likable and that she was kind of a bitch, you know, and this vague notion of it and wanting to kind of get at that topic. And then what the piece ended up being, as it was kind of hastily written, it became what really was sort of an overt endorsement of Hillary Clinton, which I think if I had more time, I would have stopped short of an endorsement, because to me, it's more important to have gotten to the core of that, the thing that Amy and I were originally trying to write about, as opposed to picking someone in the election. Because I also think, you know, comedians are better used when they don't
endorse.
And yeah, and so it made me, it was the first taste of what was going to be another run of sort of weird, kind of uncomfortable political exposure.
So both Bill and Hillary called you separately.
They did.
To thank you for the sketch. And did you feel like saying, I really didn't intend to make an endorsement?
I didn't dare. I was such a coward. I said, oh, thank you. I mean, I thought she was an excellent candidate. And I think she's a very smart woman. And it was, you would watch those debates at the time, and they seemed to be so equal in their debates and in their policy. It seemed like it was you know, good luck finding a difference between their healthcare policies. Good luck parsing that or whatever. That no, I was just mostly sweaty that I was talking on the phone to them.
So what kind of reservations did that give you about portraying Sarah Palin?
Well, it made me feel nervous about it, and that I went into it knowing that if I was going to really do it in any kind of recurring way, that I wouldn't have time to write the pieces. And yet the pieces, people would assume that the pieces were my personal point of view. And so I kind of wanted to have control of that if I could, and it ended up all working out really well, because the character, because sometimes a political character gets passed around. Any, you know, if you write a recurring character on Saturday Night Live, if you write the cheerleaders or the, you know, target lady, the etiquette is no one else can write one of those but you. But anyone can write a piece with a political figure. Anyone can write a Clinton. Anyone can write, even sometimes, you know, a Larry King, a media figure. And so I was worried about being the mouthpiece for anyone and being politicized personally by it. But it was weird because it ended up being a lot of fun. But it did kind of permanently politicize me, I think, in a way that...
Well, as you say in the book, it made you a lightning rod.
Yes.
What kind of criticism did you get from people who didn't like seeing something critical about Sarah Palin?
Well, I think you can find this, you know, freshly posted as of yesterday about, you know, like, she should be ashamed for what she did to Sarah Palin, which I think is a discredit to both me and former Governor Palin. That's just, you know, she's, I say in the book, she's not fragile and I'm not mean. And to imply otherwise is a disservice to us both. No one ever said, you know, that Will Ferrell, he should be ashamed of the way he's conducting himself playing George W. Bush. I mean, no one would ever say that. I say in the book, you know, Chris Rock at the time was touring stand-up and was saying really disparaging things, you know, about George Bush and using terms that I would even not want to use. But and no one would ever, you would never, ever see a talking head go on TV and say, like, well, I don't, Chris Rock really needs to think about what he's doing. It was very patronizing to both me and Sarah Palin.
You were worried when that night when you appeared together in the same sketch, mm-hmm. and crossed paths very briefly on camera, mm-hmm. as you left the podium and she went to it. You wanted to make sure you weren't on stage together for more than a split second. What were you worried about?
Well, one, I just had started to realize that sort of cable news kind of circus that I joke in the book is like, I just knew if there was a two shot of us that's what they would play when I die. That's what they would show on the Emmys when I die. And I'd rather have a picture of me and Tracy or me and Alec on the Emmys when I die. Yeah, and I was worried about a bunch of different things. I was worried the campaign had gotten kind of ugly, and it felt weird to be. Once again, I wanted to stop short of feeling like we were endorsing anybody. And I should say, you know, that Barack Obama was never coming on either. But I, at that time, I wouldn't have wanted to do that either, you know.
So do you feel like any of the mannerisms that you learned to do or any of the speaking style that you learned to do for Sarah Palin became a part of you?
The only thing I would say is that I say Alaska. Like, I think I really just say it like that now.
What are the other pronunciations that you got?
It's funny because I was trying to – I always say it's like flowers for Algernon, and it's just gone. She does that like I saw a clip of the video. She's like, go to jail. Like she has that – what we would call an substitution in voice class. It's funny because sometimes if we're goofing around on set or something, I will not be meaning to imitate her at all. But if I'm just joking, like in a sort of a mom voice or whatever, the crew will start laughing. 30 Rock crew will start laughing. I'm like, oh, that's, you know, they think I'm trotting out my Palin. I didn't really mean to.
You know, and talking about the kind of nasty response that you got from some people when you're doing Palin, you reprint some internet posts about like nasty internet posts about when one relates to Sarah Palin, and I'd like you to read the post and the response that you wrote for your book Bossy Pants.
Sure.
And tell us why you did this.
This was a chapter called Dear Internet, in which I answer some correspondence that I received through posts on the internet that I treat like old-timey fan letters, but because the internet is, you know, it's the repository of all human garbage. It's the worst place in the world. And this is, and you shouldn't ever respond to it, but there's something about the anonymity that I was like, oh, well, I don't have your real name, but I have your internet name, so I'd like to respond to you this way, and how do you like it? It's the worst, right? So anyway, this is from a post on TMZ.com. Posted by Kevin214 on November 9th, 2008 at 11:38 a.m. Tina Fey cheated. Anyone who has ever seen an old picture of her can see she has had 100% plastic surgery. Her whole face is different. She was ugly then and she is ugly now. She only wished she could ever be as beautiful as Sarah Palin. Dear Kevin214, what can I say? You have an amazing eye. I guess I got caught up in the whole Hollywood thing. I thought I could change 100% of my facial features and as long as I stayed ugly, no one would notice. How foolish I was. So let's wipe the slate clean. Full disclosure, here's a list of the procedures I've had done. Eye browning, nose lengthening. I get my teeth lightly hennaed each month to give them their amber luster. I've had my lips thinned, and I've had a treatment called grimage, where two fishing wires are run through my jawline and used to gather the skin until it looks like a fancy pillow. I've had sebaceous implants, small balls of Restylane placed in random locations to give the appearance of youthful neck acne. I don't have Botox. Unfortunately, I'm allergic. Instead, I have monthly injections of bromodiolone, a farm-strength rat poison. This keeps my face in a constant state of irritation and paralysis, which, of course, is indistinguishable from sexual excitement. My face is longer and thinner than it was 20 years ago, and while some might say that that is a natural effect of weight loss and aging, you and I know the truth. I pay a woman to sit on the side of my head twice a week. Madonna and Gwyneth go to her, and we've all had amazing results. Oh, listen to me. I've really changed. Why do I feel the need to name drop the fact that I am friends with Madonna Vickerson and Gwyneth Chung? Since you're so savvy at spotting plastic surgery, I'm sure you've noticed some of my other famous friends who have had work done. Bishop Desmond Tutu, cheek implants. Supreme Court Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, major boob job. And SpongeBob SquarePants, gender reassignment. Keep on helping me keep it real. T.
That's really great. I wish you wrote those all the time.
I could do another book of just those.
So when you were on Saturday Night Live, did you write much for Tracy Morgan?
I did write sometimes for Tracy Morgan. I wrote him in drag a fair amount because one of the first things that he did recurring was to play Star Jones on a parody of The View that we used to do.
Why did you think we got to put him in drag?
Well, we didn't have an African-American woman at that time. And we didn't even have Maya, who is a biracial woman. And I do think it would still, you know, it'd be great. They should find an African American woman so the guys don't have to do that. But I don't work there anymore, so that's not my problem. But,
so that's why you put him in drag, because there were no.
There was no one
women.
To play star. Yeah. And he was funny. I try to remember other things I wrote for him. I remember.
How did he feel about that?
He was fine, and he was happy to be on. You know, he's always. Thanks me for helping get him on regularly there. And we used to write updates for him. There's one that I feel like I wrote, but I hope I'm not wrong, a Weekend Update feature at a time when they were looking for a new James Bond, and it was Tracy as himself pitching himself to be the next James Bond, and talking about how he would like the Bond, his Bond girls would all be very thick, and Lane Bryant style girls.
So is Tracy Morgan a challenge to work with? Is he like a little unpredictable in terms of his behavior, his moods?
No, he's very pleasant. I mean, his mood is always pleasant. His kind of health right now is, and she's had a kidney transplant this year, and he continues to struggle with diabetes, and so that's probably the biggest challenge.
I saw you. I saw half of you because I tuned in the middle of your acceptance speech at the Comedy Awards on Comedy Central Sunday night, and you were really funny at the end. You said something about Tracy Morgan's transplant,
but he needed another one.
Yeah, and you said, "Well, she's sitting over there, so you should go to go to the table and make a donation, and or something along those lines."
If you're a lady with a kidney and you feel like giving it to Tracy,
yeah, yeah. So, is it okay with the two of you to joke like that about something that's really grave?
I hope it is. I mean, he certainly jokes about it himself, and it's funny because you're right that I never have actually asked him, like, Tracy, is it okay with you that we portray your diabetes on the show? And because we actually was portraying his character as a borderline diabetic before his diabetes became serious, and of course, in his insane character was sort of not worried about losing a foot because he would just get a wheel. And he thought that would be kind of cool to have a wheel for a foot, but I hope it's okay with him. I think it is because he
couldn't be on your show if it wasn't probably.
Well,
right?
I mean, everyone's allowed to have boundaries, you know. But I always think of him as because he is a pure comedy person and a stand-up. That I always think of getting to the meat of all that stuff is. I assume that's what we both like.
You got the Mark Twain Award at the Kennedy Center. You gave this really hysterical speech, and one of the things you said was you wonder, since this is the Mark Twain Award, you wonder if 100 years from now people will look at your work and say, wow, that's racist.
Yeah, that's what I hope. That much like Mr. Twain.
Yes, much like Mr. Twain. So do you ever wonder how people will see the Tracy Jordan character in the future and the way you walk the line on that show between like jokes about racism and portraying people who are racist or people who are stereotypes?
Mm-hmm.
You're walking really tricky lines on that show.
We do walk tricky lines, and I have seen people who complain that, you know, that the show is racist because of the Tracy Jordan character. But the Tracy Jordan character is – we take storylines for Tracy Jordan from all kinds of celebrities and for Jane's character too. And they're never made up, you know. The thing always – and I think this is also a kind of – now we're in a post-Norman Lear era where people assume – that you're trying to be instructive or exemplary with these characters. I'm like, no, these characters aren't showing you the right way to be at all. If any, you know, maybe they'll spark a discussion, but they're not prescriptive at all. But I think people expect that of their entertainment in a way. But we've done a lot of very borderline things with all kinds of stuff.
So, an example of something you thought was pretty risky that you knew might be misinterpreted, but you thought it was funny?
Within that episode where Tracy's character thinks he's going to replace his foot with a wheel, if he just wants to ignore his diabetes, there is a discussion between the character of Twofer, who is a Harvard graduate, and Grizzen.com, who are Tracy's entourage, basically. There is kind of an open discussion about cultural ignorance. Someone brings up the idea of African-American cultural ignorance about diabetes, and there are jokes about that. And like, I think .com or something says, like, no, you can, if you have diabetes, you can eat whenever you want. That's what my father told me, you know, my father told me that right before he died on my sixth birthday. And so they're just jokes and discussions. Jokes are tricky because some of it is the context and some of it is the intention of who's making the joke. You know what I mean? If you know that it's coming from a loving place or whatever, you kind of don't know.
Tina Fey, it's been so great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Tina Fey's new memoir is called Bossy Pants. On our website, we have a link to Tina Fey's 2008 Fresh Air interview, in which she talked in depth about her Sarah Palin portrayal. And we have links to our interviews with Seth Meyers, Amy Poehler, Tracy Morgan, and Alec Baldwin. That's freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR.
Every so often, a new study seems to show how terrible television is when it comes to reflecting national demographics. Latinos make up 15% of the U.S. population, but they're only 3% of characters on TV. African Americans tend to get stuck playing cops or crooks. NPR's Netta Ulaby says there is a channel that reliably shows a spectrum of educated professional minorities, and it may not be what you expect.
The room that we'd like to have redesigned is our living room slash dining room.
It's our central hub.
HGTV, Home and Garden Television, brims with designers, realtors, homebuyers, and hosts who are Latino, Asian, or African American.
The paint color is horrible.
It looks again like there's quite a bit of damage in here.
Where are the doors?
This episode of House Hunters just featured a black couple, a tech consultant and a government nuclear inspector looking at listings in Atlanta. It's the sort of couple rarely glimpsed on network television, says Professor Darnell Hunt.
I've watched HGTV for many, many years. I'm one of those home improvement junkies.
He's also a sociologist who studies minorities in the media.
Quite a few of their shows do have hosts who are people of color. You see class differences, you get to see racial and ethnic differences, you see gay and lesbian couples.
Like on the show House Hunters International.
Quentin and Mike are ready to leave Las Vegas and head south of the border.
Just steps to beach.
HGTV really started paying attention to its diversity about 5 years ago, says the channel's president, Jim Samples, because of an intern project.
We were working with a group of students, actually, from the University of Tennessee, and we asked for them to do an audit of our air.
So the interns picked a period of time
and looked at every minute of air, the programming, promotion, everything, just to get a feel for, okay, are we reflective of the diversity of the country?
The answer was it could do better. So HGTV made it more of a priority. And since then, Sample says, HGTV's audience increased 20% overall in prime time.
But among our African-American audience, for example, we're up by 50%.
50?
Yes.
HGTV has become one of the most popular cable channels for the homeowning African-American demographic. It's got higher than average viewership among upscale Latino audiences, too. That doesn't surprise Dana Mastro one bit. She's an academic who studies Latino representation on TV.
Well, I mean, you're talking about underserved viewing communities here.
Communities used to seeing Latinos stereotyped as sexpots, detectives, or dealers. HGTV shows try to reflect the country's actual makeup.
Hey, Charisse.
Hi, Kahi.
Hi.
And perhaps even more importantly, Mastro says, HGTV shows minorities as tastemakers, arbiters, decision makers.
Of course, you have dishwasher and your fridge are white.
Yeah, I was really hoping for a stainless steel maybe in the kitchen. So
that's the irony, says Dana Mastro. In spite of all this great diversity on HGTV, everybody ends up wanting exactly the same things.
Everybody does want stainless steel. Granite and stainless steel.
I want to do a stainless steel backsplash in this space.
My favorite part is the stainless steel backsplash.
Love it.
Wow.
That integrated look just looks spectacular.
That integrated look, indeed. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
The cable network HBO has built its reputation on developing original shows. It's earned praise for the way the programs feel true to real life, whether it's the Old West in Deadwood, New York single life in Sex and the City, or recovering New Orleans in Tremé. But as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, HBO begins a series this Sunday based on a best-selling fantasy book.
Some people describe Game of Thrones as The Sopranos meets Middle Earth.
I, Eddard, the House Stark, Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North, sentence you to die.
The Lord of Winterfell heads up one of several powerful families fighting to control a kingdom, which makes Game of Thrones fit the HBO template perfectly, says show co-creator David Benioff.
It's about families in conflict. It's about people trying to gain power. It's about people who are in power trying to keep it.
Still, he says, a high epic fantasy was not the easiest pitch.
Initially, I think there was a degree of skepticism and nervousness because it didn't seem like an HBO show.
It helped that Game of Thrones magic is minimal.
It's not about wizards throwing fireballs and a million orcs fighting a million elves.
That said, creepy supernatural forces are definitely afoot.
Is it Trace or the White Walkers?
White Walkers have been gone for thousands of years.
So he was lying.
The madman sees what he sees.
Game of Thrones is based on the first of a 4,000-page series of books by George R.R. Martin. Yes, that's two R's. He used to work in television. He wrote for The Twilight Zone in the 80s and Beauty and the Beast. But Martin felt limited by television's tight budgets and shooting schedules.
But I'm writing books, and in books you have an unlimited budget. And you can have a cast of thousands. You can have the most magnificent sets and castles. You can have, you know, battles in which millions of people are fighting.
So it's an irony that the books Martin created specifically as something he could never get on TV have been brought to the small screen by other people. People who say his TV sensibility actually made his books easy to adapt. Martin says he's made his peace with being, as he put it, a tourist in his own world.
There are times I say, oh, no, it's not quite the way I, oh, but it's very good the way they're doing it.
George R.R. Martin is an executive producer for Game of Thrones on HBO, and he's written a few scripts for it, too. He says the network was solicitous of his opinions, which makes sense given his book sold over 4 million copies.
So there's an enormous audience out there for fantasy, for sophisticated adult fantasy, I think.
And right now that audience is in the midst of a fantasy drought. There's no Hobbit for the foreseeable future, no great shows that appeal to fantasy fans like Lost, and it's still a few months till the summer buffet of high-end fantasy movies.
It's not reckless what they're doing.
Anthony Kelso, a media studies professor, has written about HBO. He says international rights have been selling fast. Apparently, geeks know no borders. And fantasy fans are known to buy fully loaded DVD packages. Ultimately, Kelso says, this show may be about attracting a new base of subscribers, not high ratings. Unlike traditional television, of course, HBO does not rely on ads.
Their revenue comes from the people who pay.
People perhaps like Thomas Strickland. He's an information architect in Atlanta and a hardcore fan of the books. Exactly the type HBO hopes to lure with Game of Thrones. You see, Strickland does not subscribe to HBO. Not yet.
It's a bit of an investment to purchase access to an entire channel and pay that premium for basically 1 hour of programming per week.
Yet Strickland is considering it. He's been hanging out on the HBO website, poring over every little advance video, from previews to features about costuming.
Padding, fur, not really metal armor. It just has to almost smell.
Waiting patiently for the DVDs is not an option, says Strickland. He and his friends want to start dissecting the show as soon as it airs, so they can compare it to the book they love. And they may have a solution.
It's very specific to our whole group of nerdy, geeky, wonderful friends.
They're talking about everyone chipping in for one HBO subscription.
We'll all get together, we'll have some wine, and we're going to watch the show together. Sorry, HBO.
Of course, the show's success in bringing new subscribers may determine whether Game of Thrones gets a second season. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, the BP oil spill 1 year later. It seems like yesterday. It was April 20th, 2010, when we first got the news of a blowout on an oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. At that time, I don't think many of us knew just what that meant or could have predicted how long it would take. It took months and a lot of jury-rigged equipment to stop the oil flowing from that damaged well. and we learned a lot of new terms in the days after the blowout. Junk shots, relief wells, things like that. And we learned about dispersants and booms and tarballs, and we watched this drama unfold in what felt like slow motion last spring and summer. And watching along with us was my next guest, and he's written a book about his observations and about he's changed and how he's changed his mind about what he thought was happening in those first days of the crisis. Carl Safina is president and co-founder of the Blue Ocean Institute. He also is the host of the PBS series Saving the Oceans with Carl Safina. His new book is A Sea in Flames, A Deepwater Horizon Oil Blowout. He's with us here in our New York studios. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be here again.
A very interesting book. It's almost like you're just telling us a story and how your mind is changing and what you're thinking along the time.
Well, that's the whole point of the book, is to try to really bring everybody there with me. And yeah. It was a very changeable situation, and it really still is.
And there were certain, as I'm reading through the book and you're describing it, there are certain passages near the end of the book that you talk about you changed your mind about certain personalities in the book and certain situations.
Yeah. I was really angry all summer long at the Coast Guard. And, I was really angry all summer long about a lot of things. But my mind changed particularly about the Coast Guard, because I came to appreciate later how much their hands were tied by the law. They're required to enforce the law, and the law says that the spiller is in charge of the cleanup. All summer long, I thought there were many opportunities for the Coast Guard to kind of shove BP out of the way. Now that the oil was all over everything, I mean, BP had a license to drill a hole in the ground, not to mm-hmm. pollute the whole Gulf of Mexico. And at that point, I thought that really the federal government should step in and federalize it. But what I didn't quite realize until later was how much the Coast Guard's options were limited by the law.
And did you get an idea of who actually helped write the law? I mean, could it have been the oil companies that helped write the law in this?
Well, the law was written after the Exxon Valdez, and it was really based on the model of a big boat hits something, it rips open, it spills the oil that's in it. You know how much oil there is, you know who spilled it, they have to go clean it up. And that made a lot of sense, and it's worked, you know, pretty well in a lot of spills. And nobody envisioned that 20 years after that law, mm-hmm. we would be drilling in water a mile deep and there could be a leak and the oil companies would have absolutely no idea mm-hmm. what to do about a leak in their own pipe, in their own oil well.
And you talk about meeting Thad Allen, who was in charge of the cleanup.
Yeah.
And how your views changed about him when you met him.
Yes. When I got to meet him and really, you know, put directly to him right across the table some of the things that I was most furious about. You know, the Coast Guard at one point made it a felony to go near some of these booms. And the booms, for the most part, were so silly. They really weren't doing anything. And it seemed to me part of the orchestrated attempt to keep a lot of people away from seeing what was going on. And there was certainly a lot of that. The BP and the guards that BP hired, they were harassing people. They were harassing anybody who had a camera, anybody who looked a little too interested. And it seemed like the Coast Guard was in cahoots. But Allen explained that the idea behind that was that people had actually been – I couldn't believe that. It's still hard to imagine. People had actually been – tampering a lot with the booms and
really?
And breaking these lines of booms to get boats in and out. So
you also said that when there were so many choppers in the air that they might be hitting each other.
Right,
news choppers and things.
Right, that was another thing. They had eight really near collisions in midair. So they closed the area around there to most flight. And so this looked and felt mm-hmm. When I was there, including to the aviation company, like a giant conspiracy to keep everybody away. And I think it was probably a contained conspiracy to keep people away. And I think the Coast Guard was trying to manage a situation it was finding in many ways unmanageable, and there were some unintended consequences. Thad Allen did say in a written edict that despite this idea of a felony to get near the booms, that nobody should be prevented from going and seeing what was going on. No reporters should be harassed or detained, and it should be completely open unless there is a possibility for some sort of safety hazard. Well, of course, in the enforcement of that, Anybody can decide on the spur of the moment that there's a safety hazard. So as he explained to me at the end of our conversations, often what looks like a giant conspiracy is just a lot of incompetence colliding with each other. And I found his seeming honesty and his humility rather convincing.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're chatting with Carl Safina, author of the new book, A Sea in Flames, The Deepwater Horizon Oil Blowout. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Another major player, Jane Lubchenco.
Yes.
You also said you had a change of heart a bit about her role in this.
Well, less a change of heart. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Dr. Lubchenco, and I've known her for a long time, since the mid-90s. So we usually when we see each other, we're on a first-name basis. Mm-hmm. And I could see the incredible strains she was under to try to find out what was really going on and to try to say and do the right things. But there were times when I thought she was threading the needle a little too closely and parsing words a little too finely and getting a little confusing. But what was more confusing than what she was putting out was what other people in the government and in the media were saying about what her agency was putting out. There was a tremendous amount of misinterpretation.
Such as? Give
well, for instance, they put out a somewhat confusing pie chart showing where the oil was at that period of time last summer. Certain percent was in the water, a certain percent had evaporated, a certain percent had washed ashore. And her agency is NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But the head of the EPA comes out and says in a news conference, well, NOAA says that all the oil is gone.
I remember when she said that.
And, you know, people were very, very angry at Jane Lubchenco, but her agency had, in fact, said no such thing at all, not even close. And then some of the writers who were actually looking at the pie chart seemed to really just misread it. And, I mean, I have the verbiage right in the book word for word. And it's incredible how much misinterpretation there could be. There were some things about it that were not that clear, but it got, you know, it just got sort of out of control. The confusion was amazing.
And you also talk about the White House and its White House spokesman Robert Gibbs sort of being tone deaf about what Americans needed to hear
right.
from the White House.
Right.
The wrong
right.
message was coming out.
Yeah, the people in the Gulf needed time to grieve. They didn't need to be told that everything was okay. And even though, in fact, a lot of things have played out better than our worst fears, there are still people there who are sick. And I think we're starting to appreciate this more now, that what may have looked like we completely dodged the bullet is looking like there are quite a few wounded people still. And there are still... despite the fact that many of the fish and shrimp survived and are still there, the prices are really depressed. You know, there's some concern on the part of consumers about whether the food is tainted and those kinds of things. So people are still, you know, it's not just that the place bounced back. There are still people who are really feeling it.
1-800-989-8255. Mary in Arnold. Where's Arnold, Mary?
Oh, it's in Maryland near Annapolis.
Aha. Go ahead.
I wanted to comment on the authority to order BP to take action. And the earlier in the discussion, we're talking, I believe, probably about OPA and the BP had the lead to clean up the spill. I think that there, and I'd like to offer to think about this, another source of authority for the federal government to have used, had it chosen to, that would have allowed it to direct EP in the cleanup and the control of the leaking gas, and that is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. Section 7003 gives the federal government via the Environmental Protection Agency the power to address any release of a hazardous or solid waste that might cause imminent and substantial endangerment, which is actually legally not a particularly high standard to meet and certainly would have been met in the situation. It then allows EPA to direct the entity responsible to direct cleanup and the control of the release. It's rarely used, in part because I don't think They will.
Let me get a reaction because we're mm-hmm.
yeah.
Good question, Carl.
I didn't mean to imply that the federal government could not have done more or responded quite differently. I think it's pretty clear. My strong impression is that the Obama administration was terrified to use the powers that it might have called upon to get everybody else out of the way and federalize the cleanup, because after what happened with Hurricane Katrina and with the lack of expertise in dealing with something like this, I think they were terrified that all the failure would be heaped directly upon them if they took it over. And I think that that's why they decided not to. I think they probably could have.
Mistake, you think?
I don't know, because I don't know how they might have done it. You know, BP really just doesn't do much except hire contractors. And in a real way, the federal government, if they knew which contractors they simply wanted to hire to do that kind of work, they could have done it. But I think the risk of doing a lot that really didn't work and that wasted a lot of time and money was very high. In fact, I think that the way that BP conducted its activities all summer wasted an absolutely staggering amount of time and money doing things that made absolutely no difference.
Such as?
Dragging booms around, putting booms on shrimp boats and having them drive through oil slicks where the water just went right over them. I mean, I have aerial pictures that I took myself of all of the oily water going directly over the boom, and it looks like the boats are just stirring it. And they spent millions, I would say, sending thousands of people out day after day going around in circles. And I think it was just giving them something to do so they wouldn't riot, really, quite frankly.
Hmm. Do we know what happened to the oil?
Not exactly, but we do know that some of it is in the water. A lot of it dissipated in various ways. Microbes ate a lot of it. It got diluted in the vast volume of the Gulf of Mexico. Some of it evaporated. Some of it came on shore. Some of it is in the sediment. It did a lot of things in different directions, and some of it is still coming up in the places especially that were heavily oiled, where it's some of it is sitting on the seafloor, and when the water stirs it, it comes back.
If we have a hurricane season again and there are big hurricanes in the Gulf, could that bring some of that oil?
Yeah, you will. I would say you would certainly see some of it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't expect you would see thick mats of it. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I mean, I don't think the future of that could be worse than it was at the height of it.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Carl Safina, author of A Sea in Flames, The Deepwater Horizon Oil Blowout, on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. So what are the take-home lessons from now we've had a year to think about?
Oh, there are so many. For one thing, we had 30 years of incredibly advancing sophistication with deep drilling and absolutely no attention on what to do if there's a leaking pipe. It is an oil well, after all. You would think that they would know how to catch the oil if some of it started leaking. A lot of that was actually mandated in Congress after the Exxon Valdez, that we were supposed to put money into developing ways of picking up oil out of seawater, and almost all of that was slashed from budget after budget and totally defunded.
The NOAA budget.
The NOAA budget, right. And I mean, I think that the reason that happened was part of this same very broad sweep of deregulation that has, I would say, afflicted us now for the last 30 years. And so I see the banking collapse and the bailout and this blowout as part of one enormous gesture to make it very hard, if not impossible, for the government to protect the long-term public interests while, in fact, aiding the shorter-term narrow interests.
The killer bees.
Well, so I think that's one of the other thing is that the main problem with oil and other fossil fuels is not the oil that we spill, because that does eventually dissipate. It's the oil that we burn, which is actually causing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to concentrate. And that is creating an imbalance in the heat budget of the entire planet. It's acidifying the oceans. And it's creating enormous and unprecedented long-term problems globally that everybody will have to deal with in a variety of ways. The other thing is that the more concentrated you make energy, the more concentrated you make the risks, and accidents always happen. They'll happen again.
Are the new oil leases that are coming out again, do they have better blowout preventers on them now, or do they have better drilling techniques than they had before?
They have better oversight of their plans. I don't think that they would get away with just having walruses in the plans for the Gulf of Mexico, because people in the past just didn't even bother to read those plans. They have better oversight. They broke up the oversight service so that the enforcement and the oversight is different from the part of it that is supposed to encourage more resource extraction. So that is better. But the blowout preventers... we only learned a few weeks ago that fundamentally in the design of this blowout preventer, the force of the blowout caused the pipe to bend slightly. It was off center by about an inch, and that seems to have prevented the blowout from being able to – I mean the preventer from being able to actually shear the pipe. So fundamentally that's the same. There's no more hardware than there was to deal with what I think will be an inevitable reoccurrence at some point. The damage cap is still $75 million. BP has spent billions of dollars that they weren't required by law to spend. And another oil company just decides not to do it, or does it in a place where there are not so many people. They're just not required to pay much. And Congress decided not to up that cap, which to me is astonishing. It's the first easy thing that could be done. We're still giving giant subsidies to the oil companies. Why are we doing that? We need to develop all kinds of alternative fuel, harness the eternal energy that actually runs the planet, that is not subject to these kinds of spills and explosions and hazards. And we're still putting out the banquet for the sumo wrestlers and leaving the entrepreneurs starving.
All right. Thank you very much, Carl, for taking time to be with us today.
You're very welcome.
Carl Safina is president and co-founder of the Blue Ocean Institute, also the host of the PBS series Saving the Oceans with Carl Safina. His new book, A Sea in Flames, The Deepwater Horizon Oil Blowout. Very informative if you want a blow-by-blow account of what happened last year. He was here in our New York studios. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much, Ira. I really appreciate it.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about... herpes. You're going to want to know about this new research about the herpes simplex virus type 2, and how many people have it and have no idea that they have it and can easily spread it. So stay with us. We'll be right back to talk about that.